welcome to the Poem of the Week. Each week, our poems are intended to help you practice the best, most current medicine by alerting you to studies that could change your practice. As usual, our host this week is National Public Radio's Dr. Michael Wilkes and Essential Evidence Senior Editor Dr. Mark Abel. Gentlemen.
Hello, Mark.
Hey, Mike.
You know, poems that you chose are intended to educate our listeners to what's going on in clinical practice. But, you know, not infrequently, you chose poems or research articles that are sort of mythbusters and things that we've often assumed are just the way things are. And all of a sudden, somebody comes along and does a study and says, hey, you know, we don't really need to do that, or it doesn't make any sense to do that. So today you've chosen one of those mythbusters. It's published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it looks at the use of oxygen in patients who are having an MI or thought to be having an MI who are not hypoxic. So the conventional teaching is that patients with an MI should certainly be put on oxygen. They should have cardiac monitoring, perhaps given an aspirin, give some IV access, but they should certainly be put on oxygen. The thinking is that the oxygen is going to relieve the ischemic pain, maybe help stabilize their hemodynamic status, reduce some ischemia that they might be having. And it's in addition to other routine hospital procedures like anxiolytics and EKGs, et cetera. So we give supplemental oxygen, certainly to patients when their arterial SAT is less than 90%, and also patients who are at high risk, for example, those who have heart failure or other high risk features for hypoxia. The question, I guess, is then, does supplemental oxygen in patients without hypoxia lead to any benefits, or are there harms? So we all can think of all the reasons why it might be good to give somebody oxygen, but what about the harms? For example, too much oxygen might occur with the administration of oxygen to normal people. And we know that too much oxygen can have a vasoconstrictive effect on the coronary arteries. So we turn to the literature to help us understand what we're doing. You found a poem that was recently published, as I mentioned, in the New England Journal. It starts on page 1240. It asks the clinical question, does the use of oxygen therapy improve outcomes in patients with suspected MI who do not have hypoxia at baseline? Very interesting question, Mark. What did they find?
Yeah, they studied patients with suspected MI because by the time you've confirmed the diagnosis, then, you know, the patient could have potentially benefited or not from oxygen. So they found patients with chest pain or shortness of breath. They had either EKG changes or elevated trope, and they all had a normal oxygen saturation, relatively normal, at least 90% on pulse ox. And they had it was a big study. They had 6,629 patients total, half in each group. So half got oxygen and half got ambient room air. They were recruited from ambulance services, ERs, coronary care units, cath labs. The final diagnosis was MI in about 3 out of 4 patients. The oxygen group got oxygen at 6 liters per minute by open face mask for a median of 12 hours. It had to be at least 6 hours, and the median duration was 12 hours. There were some crossovers, not surprisingly, about 8% in the ambient air, room air group got oxygen anyway. The clinician said, no, I need to give this patient oxygen. Maybe they desatted, not clear what happened exactly. And then about 2% in the oxygen group didn't tolerate it for some reason and got room air instead. So they did 2 analyses. They did an intention to treat analysis, which was looking at patients as they were randomized and ignoring the crossovers. And they did a per protocol, which looked at what the patient actually got. So if they crossed over, they were randomized to room air and ended up getting oxygen, they were counted as having gotten oxygen. So what they found, the primary outcome was all-cause mortality at 1 year, and there was no difference between groups, 5% in the oxygen group, 5.1% in the ambient air group. The results were similar between per protocol and intention to treat. There was no difference when they looked at subgroup analyses. They also looked at death at 30 days, and they looked at hospitalization rates at 30 days and a year rehospitalization. Again, no difference in any outcomes. They say when they did their power calculation, and remember, this is a huge study, 6,600 patients, they estimated a rate of 14% mortality. The observed rate was lower, so we don't know. It's possible that they didn't have adequate power to detect a small difference, although in general, when I think about the statistics of this, usually the highest sample size is needed, the closer your outcome rate is to 50%. So actually having a lower rate than possible probably didn't hurt their sample size much. In any case, bottom line, in patients with suspected MI and normal saturation or, you know, greater than 90%, giving immediate supplemental oxygen does not change mortality at 30 days or 1 year, doesn't affect rehospitalization rates, and is something we should strongly question. So, Mike, is this going to change practice?
Well, that's the question. I mean, we know that as a profession, change slowly most of the time, and that when we do change more rapidly, there's some sort of an incentive that drives our behavior, and it's unfortunately usually financial. And so perhaps if insurance companies change their reimbursement patterns or hospitals recognize that they could save money by not using oxygen when they don't need it, we might see institutional pressure for us to change behavior.
Maybe. Sometimes, you know, it's funny, sometimes we change really quickly. Remember COX-2 inhibitors and how quickly it seemed like all of a sudden no one was using NSAIDs anymore. I was the only person in the practice that I was in at the time still prescribing naproxen. Everyone else switched over to Celebrex or Vioxx right away. It seemed like within a month. And yet then, of course, it turned out they weren't as good as we thought. There were some harms. They were taken off the market, some of them. So, you know, it's interesting. Sometimes we change very, very quickly, and other times we change very, very slowly.
Right.
And so I think, you know, this is one where it'll probably take another trial. I think there's also this interesting question of where the study gets done. And this was, I'm not positive. I think this might have been done in the UK or in the US? I think it was in the US. It was a US trial. So that may help change practice more than if it was done overseas. I was talking to an author of a trial on using blood glucose monitoring, self-blood glucose monitoring in type 2 diabetics who are not on insulin. And this was a big study. It was in JAMA Internal Medicine. It was the first U.S. study. And still, and as you know, most patients with type 2 diabetes are still told they have to check their sugar every day.
They're religious.
There's six studies in Europe, like four in the U.K., two in the Netherlands. None of them, big, well-designed studies, none showed any benefit of self-glucose monitoring, yet it has had no impact on practice here in the States. Maybe having a study here in the U.S. will convince us that it doesn't help our patients. But, you know, this whole issue of when we change practice, when we abandon something versus adopting something, I think we're quicker to adopt new things than we are to abandon ineffective older things. I think that's one difference.
Yeah. I mean, again, listeners won't be surprised to hear me say that, you know, part of this is the bio-industrial complex. And, you know, there's an industry that pushes hard for diabetes home monitoring. And, you know, I'm not sure there's an industry that pushes hard for oxygen, but there certainly was a huge industry.
Oh, I had the oxygen rep. The oxygen rep just brought us lunch.
Right.
Yeah.
But,
right.
You know, these oxygen, you know, reps, I'm about to be a little facetious, but for those of you who have traveled outside the United States and to airports and things, there are now these flavored oxygen bars, and you go up, they usually stand around the periphery of these stands. In airports, and you get a tube and you get to choose your flavor and you breathe in the oxygen, presumably, you know, to get a boost in energy or clarity in thinking or something. I've never done it. But again, a great example of people who are doing something, you know, without any medicinal benefit and are willing to pay a lot of money for it.
I agree.
I'll see you at the oxygen bar next week. Thanks, Mark.
Sounds like a plan.
Well, that's this week's poem. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to read this and other recent poems, please go to www.essentialevidence.com. And please join us again next week for another medical poem.